everybody, and welcome to another episode of Banking Matters. I'm your host, Lindsay Hughley, and joining me today is Mark Kennealy. Mark is the co-leader of Alston & Byrd's corporate area and bank practice. And previously, Mark served as the firm's as the chair of the firm's management committee, as well as the chair of the firm's financial services and products group. Mark focuses his practice on the banking space, where he assists his clients with mergers and acquisitions, IPOs, public and private capital raising transactions, corporate governments, and a host of related regulatory matters. Throughout the economic cycle, Mark has worked on some of the most innovative and recognized transactions in the country. Welcome, Mark. We are so glad to have you here.
Thank you for having me. Good to be here with you, Lindsay.
Yes, absolutely. So here at Banking Matters, we always like to ask our guests, how did you get started working with financial institutions?
So I caught a break there, I guess. I was in law school and I met a girl from Atlanta. And she is, of course, the story, it's a good ending. She winds up being my wife in the story. So we've been married now for almost 30 years, but I moved to Atlanta in 96. Got married, and at the time, Alston & Byrd was hiring in their community banking group, their financial services group. And it was a wonderful time in the Southeast, if you remember the kind of era of the mid-90s and all the regional banks that were sort of dominating the scene then. Really active space, and we were one of the few firms that had a financial services practice area that had developed to focus on that space. And so I kind of jumped right in. A lot of public company work right out of the gate, a lot of heavy regulatory work. We were a busy group, and so very fortunate to kind of land on my feet the way I did. But it was one of the first law firms I'm aware of that had sort of that focus in the Southeast as a practice area. And again, if you look at the number of banks that were in the Southeast back in the 90s, it was an awful lot. So we're a lot of targets. It's been a great run.
That's awesome. And I totally agree with the segment. And even now, I feel like there's really not that many firms out there that do focus in the financial services area. Because I'm in Tennessee. And so I know that whenever we've had to rope in people when I've been in the bank, we've had to reach far and wide for a firm that would be able to help us, that specializes in especially the types of things that was listed that you've worked with.
Yeah, and I'll just say one other thing kind of about the history of it is, my wife and I like to go for a walk on Sundays. And I've told her on that walk, I don't know how many times, what a blessing it is to work in a space with so many nice people in it. From the bankers, the investment bankers, my competitors, I mean, they're the lawyers I work with, all intelligent, good people. And so it's been a real treat to be in the space and work with so many nice people.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're glad you're here. And so to jump in today, I really want to dig into mergers and acquisitions. And so really just dive in 2 feet in. I'd like to start with, so from your viewpoint and your experience, how and when does a bank really know that they're ready to buy or to be bought? What are some things that they're going to look at, consider? What are they going to be feeling?
Sure. So Lindsay, maybe a couple things first. I think one is, what a terrific time in our space, right? And that's not a political statement, but what a wonderful time with the regulatory rollback. And it feels like everything's kind of viable again. If you want to do M&A, it's a good time to do M&A. It's not to say the regulators will approve every deal that comes along, but there's certainly been an acceleration of approval timelines, a space that's more conducive to deals. And so that's all great. Second is, I do get asked from time to time, hey, Mark, will you come to our meeting and give us a regulatory update? And I said, well, it won't take me very long because all I'm going to do is list out all the things that have been repealed. And so for banks even that aren't interested in M&A, what a great time. But, capital's available, et cetera. In terms of, knowing as a buyer that you're ready to be a buyer or as a seller that you're ready to be a seller, I guess I'll start with the buyer side of that. Every bank out there has a strategic plan, right? We all sit down and do our strategic planning sessions every year. And so, a good starting point is to say, well, how does this even fit into it, right? If we like what we're doing and we think we're accreting value for our shareholders, continue to engage in organic growth, why would we interrupt that with a deal that could go bad? And I think you got to look at it through a number of lenses. I think one is, does it get us into new markets? So there are geographic markets that we are just not in. Does it enable us to attract talent or bring talent over as part of the deal so that something we don't have and want to be deeper in, we have that opportunity so that you just scale the thing out through people? I mentioned markets in a geographic sense. You also get products and services, you know, that you may find your way into new product offerings. Some of those might be non-interest income strategies. Maybe you pick up someone who's got good trust operations, mortgage operations, SBA, or maybe it is just down the fairway of you know, regular balance sheet activities, but it's an asset class you haven't been in a strong way in the past. Reputation. It's, you know, when you enter a new market area, it's key to have new people. If you acquire a bank that has good people, you also improve your reputation in that market area. I would say looking at technology and innovation, you know, for the 4,500 or so banks that we have out there, they can't all afford to invest in innovative technology. It's nice where you can pair up in places. And so maybe you bring over a team that, you know, find a bank that's already done some of what you want to do. And sometimes it's just expertise. It's just even a bank that is familiar with dealing with banking as a service or fintech, that you get some expertise there just to help you as you bump around with those players in that space. Scale obviously is important. I think, you know, we work with a lot of banks that say we're wringing our hands at, you know, 600 million. We feel like if we could get over a billion, that it would really help on a scale front for some of the things that we aspire to in the way of efficiencies. And so scale can be important. And then, you know, the last questions I kind of ask acquirers are, hey, before you get excited about doing a deal, if you heard all that and you're still interested, do you actually know how to do a deal? Do you have the raw materials in terms of, you know, human resources and the like to make this work? And are the assumptions that you're using reasonable? And so from the buyer side, I look at that a number of those things have to come together at the board level. This is, you know, management is just part of the equation. They may bring the idea to the board, but the board has to be convinced that this is actually good and that they're willing to step either away or through that strategic plan I started with to sort of say, this is something we want to do. From the seller side, just kind of changing gears. I mean, you hear people say it all the time, and it's true. I mean, a lot of times age is just the key factor here. You get, you know, a superannuated board of directors, so kind of a little bit long in the tooth, and it's hard to engage in refreshment and succession planning. Or you get an aging management team, and it would be, you know, really an overhaul of the bank on a number of levels to bring in new people. And you say, let's just go ahead and change things up here. Second is liquidity, is that if you've had shareholders who've owned the shares for a long time, a seller can say, hey, 15 years is long enough, whatever the time period is. We need to find our path to liquidity. We're not doing an IPO. We want to go find a partner who has a good currency, and that's our way out. Sometimes it's just a need for new strategic energy that you, as a seller, you say, well, gosh, we're kind of in a rut. We're in the same three markets we've been in, and we seem to be kind of the same scale. Let's find the right partner. And so I do think for some sellers, saying out loud, this is an opportunity to go find a good partner. I hear people talk a lot about, you know, the bid process and auction process and, you know, throwing fiduciary elements in there as well. And I get all that. And we counsel on that as well. But there are times that if you're a good seller and there's a buyer whose currency you really want to hold and who you really want to partner with for the benefit of your employees, the benefit of your customers, your markets, that you should go do that. And then the last one I'll put on the list, I do hear this from time to time, is just frustration, which is it's not always milk and honey in our space. And sometimes the regulatory burn can be difficult. Sometimes, you know, it takes longer to build up, you know, the asset base you want in a particular strata. It can be a frustrating space. It still is a slow, steady growth kind of space over time. And so I do see frustration sometimes set in. I would say if the sellers are feeling those things, that's a good time to start looking. The advice of a good investment banker is absolutely critical. It is, you got to find someone who looks at this problem with you and doesn't see a better solution on the one hand, or is at least enthusiastic about the let's go sell the bank solution. That is absolutely central to the board's decision to move forward or not.
Absolutely. And I will say my career path that I've been through, the banks that I've been with the longest, we did 4 acquisitions just in like 5 years. It was very, and so being able to, like, I've seen so many of those different scenarios as far as from our standpoint versus especially, and then also what I know now about where those banks were in the position that they were in. And also I'm in a very small rural area, and I know that it was essentially the kind of thing of they were feeling these things and they reached out to each other, and it was more of a partnership. Most of them were family owned banks, They've been working in the same space for 30 plus years together. We've known the history of them. And it was more of a joining arms kind of thing so that the longevity and the history of those banks can still remain in those communities. And so I am very much thankful for mergers and acquisitions for sure. And when they do happen, just so that they can keep the community banks in those places and spaces that they are so needed.
Let me add a couple of things at Lindsay, because I totally agree. I think to your first point, you mentioned the bank that did, you know, four or five deals in a you know, 5 year period or something. I mean, if it's the kind of thing where you can pull off a deal and get it done, right? Because when you go to do a deal, everyone on your roster already had a full-time job before you brought an M&A opportunity to them. If you have a team that can effectively get it done, that's a good thing. Second really good thing is, if you look back at the assumptions you used going into the deal and you executed well enough to at least hit close to those assumptions, they'll never be exactly right. And so that you can actually benefit from the deal the way you thought you would. Those banks should absolutely keep looking at deals. That is now part of their DNA and part of their makeup. And I totally agree with you. And we see those be some of the best deals. The second thing you said, which is about banks coming together, I also totally agree. We're seeing a lot of right now with lower premiums and a lot of the acquirer stock. We're seeing a lot of just good old fashioned private bank A goes and talks to private bank B. Wouldn't we be better together? We don't need to be a public company. Maybe we will, but we don't need to be. But if we had a combined talent base, combined market areas, isn't that more powerful? And that's I think we're going to see a lot more of that.
Yeah, for sure. And what's funny is that the bank that did do those, they've just, in the 5 years that I've been gone, they just went through another one. And they just want, like, they really do have the team, like you said, that knows what they're doing. They know what they're looking for. And so that has definitely been on their side. So as much as things to look out for, how it feels, I'd like to also dig into, so what are some legal landmines per se that may pop up in the process, or maybe some things that could blindside someone within a merger and acquisition?
So I make the joke on every deal that we work on. I say, look, I tell the client, when we get to the end, we'll tell you we're done with the merger agreement, but the last two things we're going to get done are the disclosure schedules and whatever the people plan, you know, the retention agreements, the new employment agreements, the severance plan, everything relating to people. Those are easily the two biggest landmines in terms of stuff that bubbles up. Because on the disclosure schedule side, you know, look, that's supposed to reflect your diligence. So the acquirer goes in, looks at target, asks a lot of good questions. We build out representations and warranties. But in the banking space, if you bought it, it's yours. There's no take backs. Once you merge two banks together, if you discover something there that you missed, too bad. There's no indemnity. There's no let's go get money back from target shareholders. It's yours. And so you really got to make sure you're doing the push-ups there. The disclosure schedules tie to those reps and warranties. And that's where you list out stuff like material agreements, maybe loans on the exception list. You know, anything that you want to make sure you are aware of and have seen, it's critical to get that right. I see a lot of surprises at the end because that is one of the slower items to come together. You get a target, they're not used to putting schedules together. It represents a new work stream that they, you know, didn't think they'd have to devote the time to. That can be clumsy. On the people side, every bank has its own group of personalities, egos, et cetera. It's not unusual you find someone who doesn't want to sign a new agreement, and that's a surprise to someone. It's not unusual you find a loan producer that ends up wanting to leave. And so you do sometimes see that on the people side, you get some surprises. And that can include on taxation of payouts. So if you have change of control agreements or other severance obligations, sometimes the tax wrinkle can create some work streams. But I'd say easily it's the two biggest legal landmines come up in the context of the disclosure schedules and the people.
Absolutely. And sometimes, like you said, with the people portion of things, I'm currently working with the bank that's going through a merger and acquisition, and we've had over the last 2 months just randomly we'll come into work and they'll say, oh, so and so has decided to go or what have you. And so it is a very what's going on kind of thing, and like you said, they can change their mind at the drop of a hat.
Yeah, for the acquirers listening, what I would say, and I guess sellers as well, there is a critical moment where when the deal is announced, the average employee, whether he or she is, you know, a superstar or not, has to be convinced of two things. That when they go home that night and their spouse asks them, are you going to still have a job? That they know the answer to that. and are our benefits going to change? And I can't tell you how often I see the banks talk past each other on what sounds like something so simple, but it needs to be the case that the acquirer is walking through with the talent base at the target at as much depth as they can get into those two questions.
Yeah, for sure. And so also kind of pivoting off of that, what is one piece of legal due diligence that community banks consistently underestimate?
Two things I see people miss a lot. The first one is exclusivity, is that there's a lot of vendors out there or counterparties or even partners that when they say, hey, we want to, you know, have this relationship with you, they slip into the agreement, this concept of exclusivity. And of course, what happens is 3 or 4 years go by and you kind of forget about it. And then you go do this deal with this other bank and they have also exclusivity with some other party that does something similar. We see that come up way too often, especially with a lot of the nifty relationships banks are entering into nowadays with, you know, players in the fintech space and banking as a service and the like. You'll sometimes see that in there. Just be careful that you don't actually trip over that, because as I say, once you close the deal and there's this realization that you violated it, it's almost too late. The second one is, a lot of acquirers think, well, the minute I sign the agreement up, the target bank is kind of mine, right? That it's I'm going to kind of run it till closing. And that is not how the banking rules work. And so I would say the second place we see surprises come up sometimes, or there should be a little more legwork put in, is making sure you understand how much under the Federal Reserve's control framework can we as the acquirer work with the target to do things like approve loans? Can we sit in committee meetings as observers? Can we get updates on a regular basis? Understand the parameters of what interactions the two banks can have together. On the one hand, you want the two banks to work as much together as they can. You want the closing and the integration to be as smooth as possible, and that you open your doors day one post closes, one bank ready for customers, everybody's trained up and ready to go. And on the other hand, you can't be calling balls and strikes at the target bank when you're the acquirer as to anything that looks like you're controlling the bank. There's a balance to be struck there. I think that's a critical part of why you're negotiating the merger agreement, also talking to each other about expectations there and how you can balance that and make it work. I see a number of folks come away disappointed when, the target bank says, well, wait, you can't come sit in my loan committee and approve my loans. That's a conversation that needs to be had.
Awesome. And so kind of one last piece to wrap it up. From a regulatory standpoint, what are regulators actually looking for during a community bank merger? Like, in order to approve it through the process, what are some key things that they're looking for?
Well, I mean, the basics haven't changed, right? You got to have strong regulatory capital. So you got to meet the minimums to be a pro forma Camel II bank. You need to have a low CRE ratio, nothing over greater than 300%, unless there's a good story of why your CRE is different or why you have capital to support that. I think it's helpful if you have a lack of public comments that come in while the agreement's pending. You have the anti-competitive concerns, the old, HHI that we all study. And of course, that's kind of in flux at the moment. But to me, the real question you're asking is, when you think about a deal being approved, the regulators want to avoid being embarrassed. They don't want to approve a deal and then something bad happens there's some sort of BSA AML issue that was pervasive that should have been dealt with. There's legacy compliance issues that were missed. There's an ERM framework that's not up to snuff for the size of the bank. I think that's really the key, is, are we going to get embarrassed? Are we going to approve this deal and that 9 months later, the bank's under a public consent order, or 6 months later? And so you kind of add all those up. The big ones I went through on capital and CRE, the ones that you can kind of in an objective way avoid. But there's also this, are we really ready for this component to it from a systems, controls, and procedures and processes perspective that you really can put the two banks together and be ready to operate?
Awesome. And you have given us such good things to think about. I know that a ton of our listeners are really going to walk away from this podcast with a lot of good information, things to be aware of. And as we wrap up, we always like to ask, what's one piece of advice you'd like to leave our listeners with?
The biggest piece of advice I'd give, because given this is an M&A podcast, I'll say that when you look at your M&A model, your financial model, be realistic. Think about where there's some risk that you want to achieve certain of the, whether it's cost savings or some other dynamic in there. It's okay to miss those, but just be realistic about it in front of your board so that you avoid surprises afterwards. So if you do one and the numbers are a little off, you're still looking at the totality of the deal as being a good deal, and there's some margin for error on the numbers.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Mark. I
Yeah,
appreciate
thanks
your
for having
time.
me. Great to be with you.
Yes. And for the rest of our listeners, that's Banking Matters.